Good evening, folks. Welcome back to That's a Retro with Lucas. Today I've invited a special guest, Dr. James Walsh, to talk about the impact of U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War on American culture. Could you please introduce yourself, Dr. Walsh?
Hi. Thank you, Lucas. Thanks for having me. I'm Jim Walsh. I've been a history professor here at NEC for the last 26 years. And it's an interesting question. The only major impact the war had on my individual life was in the stress of being concerned that I might be drafted. I think pretty much everyone of my age group lived under that potential life-changing experience, and many of us, I wouldn't even guess at the percentage of us that were concerned that the United States was engaged in a not very good war, and we didn't want to take part in it. So other than that, I can't think of too much other impact that it had on me or my family in particular. None of my relatives were of draft age, and none of them went to Vietnam.
Was there any noticeable impact on your education during the war?
No, I don't think so. I went to school and to college in the South, which was not a hotbed of anti-war activity. So it's not like being at Berkeley where you didn't know if you were going to have a class that day because of the demonstrations on campus. Certainly the major cities saw a lot of things that would have interfered, mass demonstrations and things like that, but no, nothing that most of my teachers ignored it.
How about when you were in college after the war had already ended? Did you see any impact that was like any of that residual kind of lasting effects from Vietnam War on the culture of being in college?
I remember working while in college with a veteran, and the war was just ending at that point in time, and he had some pretty grisly stories to tell about his experience over there. But again, it would depend on the campus. Ours was not a big active campus. It was a very young school, and people didn't pay attention to that sort of thing.
Did you feel any kind of cultural shift in general after the war had ended, or even during the war?
Yeah, I think there is a huge cultural shift that takes place in America between the early 1960s and, let's say, maybe 1975. It's a period where, you know, when we went into the 60s, what marked the beginning of that with the inauguration of John F. Kennedy in January of 1961, and it was a time of prosperity in America. It was a time of the blossoming of hope. We had a bright, young, energetic president taking over for the previous generation. He even mentions that in his inauguration speech. The torch has been passed to a new generation. And everything looked like it was going to proceed on an upward track for America at that point in time. And then 3 years later, Kennedy's dead, struck down by an assassin's bullet, and that's followed up within a couple of years by the unfortunate decision to immerse our national treasure and lives into a war 3,000 miles away that a lot of people didn't understand the why and wherefore of what we were doing there. You follow that up with the subsequent assassinations of Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King in 1968. You find out that the government has been lying to us all along. by the end of the 60s about the Vietnam War. Then you have the Watergate incident and the fall of Richard Nixon's presidency by 1975, and you find a different America at the end of that long decade. It's the result of that as soon as Nixon's gone, Gerald Ford takes over, loses the presidency to Jimmy Carter, and then in 1980, during the presidential race, Carter makes that woeful speech about the malaise that America has fallen into, and Reagan jumps all over it and turns it around into not a confessional but a condemnation of American culture. When Carter was right, America was in a malaise. Nothing was working right for us. The only thing that had succeeded was we managed to get a man on the moon in 1969. But other than that, things were not going well for people. And Carter acknowledged that. Maybe that was a mistake. Maybe the American people don't want to be told that things aren't hunky-dory. But the reality was they weren't.
And speaking of college campuses earlier, how do you think the Vietnam War changed student life in the U.S.?
I like to think that the Vietnam War and the protesting that resulted from it changed campuses into something more activist than has certainly been in the recent years. One of the most important things that we can learn from 20th century history is that when changes are necessary in a country around the world, it's usually a university campus and its students and its concerned faculty that lead the charge to try to get something done. When there's protests in Israel, when there's protests in France, when there are protests anywhere in the world, those protests come off of college campuses. And I think that's the strength of a college. If you're getting a good education, you should be told to question everything. Mm-hmm. If you don't like what you're seeing, then do something about it. Get up and raise your hand and say, "Hey, we need to fix this."
What about things like events like Kent State? How do you think those had a lasting impact on the U.S. and on college campuses and how they're run, whether it's today or whether it was the recent history after they happened?
Well, Kent State was a tragedy of epic proportions. Obviously, it turns into a relatively high-selling popular song. I think it may have acted to muzzle protest on campus for a short while, and then at other schools it probably impelled more protest. It was certainly a shock to those of us who were watching it happen on TV or saw it on the evening news, and I think it made most of us pretty damn angry. How it's changed America, I don't think it's changed America. I don't think it's changed campuses either. If you have something that you need to see fixed, you shouldn't expect that to happen again. I think you should work towards whatever you happen to believe is right, and that's where we should go with that.
Do you think it changed the relationship between students and faculty in their own campuses and maybe the administration?
No, because Kent State was not the fault of Kent State University. It wasn't the fault of any faculty. It was the government that sent the National Guard there. It was the commanders of the National Guard that didn't keep their men under control. The conservative reaction to anti-war protest that allowed some extremists to put armed military on a college campus and slaughter, what, four students who were protesting freely and legally.
Can you see any parallels between Kent State and similar events and things that have happened in more recent years with protests on campuses?
Well, I think most protest in recent years has left campus, which is a good thing and a bad thing. I think a lot of the protest in the last 10 years has been centered in cities, urban areas. It's been more moved towards basic human rights and civil rights than it has been about political movements. You don't see people out trying to get us out of Ukraine or stop funding Ukraine. You don't see people out demonstrating against political things as much as you're worried about, for instance, discrimination. The George Floyd protests and the Black Lives Matter protests have truly eclipsed anything else, and those aren't happening on campus. The only campus protests we've had lately, I think, have been the anti-Israel protests that take place, or should we say pro-Gaza protests that have taken place. I think the overreaction of certain colleges to what goes on campus is probably a bad thing. Whether it happens because they're overly protective or underprotective of what goes on is a question in each incident. We did nothing here. When you think about it, there were no protests on our campus and haven't been in years. Well, we had the one against the presence of Don Bolduc a year or so ago. But other than that, it's been pretty quiet.
Yeah, I remember that one. I had some friends who went to that one. At the time, during the Vietnam War, do you think that the nation had ever seen student protests like the ones that we saw during the war up to that point, or do you think it was largely something that hadn't even occurred to people on college campuses?
I can't recall any major protest in America on college campuses until Vietnam broke out, and certainly not before 1965-66. It's probably safe to say that the civil rights demonstrations that had been taking place in the United States in the early 60s paved the way for Vietnam War demonstrations in the later 60s and into the early 70s. The fact that a lot of protest was taking place and that a pretty relegated group of our population, that is Black people, were out in the street being beaten, being hosed, being gassed, and still braving the streets in order to get their point across. I think that set an incredible and impressive standard for college students to follow, not only to support civil rights, but then to think that the crowd's power to stop a war they didn't believe in would be useful. And the campus was not the only place they demonstrated. They demonstrated all over the city streets.
You mentioned that, like, in events like during Kent State, it wasn't really the college that had a lot to do with it. It was more of the government. How do you think the trust between the American people and their government was impacted by Vietnam, and how do you think that still shows today?
Well, I think that malaise that Carter spoke of is partly to do with the fact that our population really doesn't trust the government to tell us the truth anymore. I don't think we've gotten over that yet. I don't think that there are two strands, of course. There's the anti-constitutional, anti-federal government stance that a lot of these modern day militias have adopted. The states' rights people, the people who would rather not have a strong central government, that's been in place in America since the 1780s. Then you have people who lived through the Vietnam era and hearken back to some of the things that were being done, not only about Vietnam, but about civil rights. The over-investigation of Martin Luther King's life by J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, the problem psychologist whose files were stolen by the FBI and released to the public to discredit him and his anti-war views, all the sneaky things that the government did during the Vietnam War, keeping the body count down, exploding the body count of our so-called enemies, hiding the fact that we were not winning a war, we were actually barely staying in a civil war in a country that we had no place to be. That really pulled down the implicit trust of the American people in our national government.
Do you think a lot of that distrust was amplified by the Iraq War and everything to do with that, as well as the war in Afghanistan?
Well, two separate conflicts with two separate bad reasons for happening. Afghanistan first, because we got in there, well, if you don't count the Kuwait War, if you count Afghanistan as a discrete war, it shouldn't have happened. We should have adopted Israel's Munich tactics from the 1970s and not invaded a sovereign country, and that would have kept us out of what is now our longest war. I think the idea that the second Iraq War was founded on some misunderstandings, to put it nicely, of the conditions in Iraq when our government decided that they had weapons of mass destruction and we needed to eliminate them, I think it reveals a little bit, at least, about how our government still isn't telling us exactly everything it knows. And while many people in the government will argue that, well, we don't want to panic the people, or we don't want to create any kind of situation in society by not telling the public everything, we also don't need to be getting into wars over something that isn't true either. So we do need more transparency.
The need for blood is constant, and sometimes that need becomes critical. From accident victims and cancer patients to premature babies and those with blood disorders, hospital patients rely on all of us to make sure that blood is on the shelves and ready to help. That's why the American Red Cross needs you. Make an appointment to give blood today by calling 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcrossblood.org. Your one blood donation can help save more than one life. During the Vietnam War, how did the general public react to the protests? Like, did they align more often with protesters or more so with the government, or did it kind of depend where you were at the time?
I think it depended somewhat on geography, and I think it depended even more on age. I say that because, you know, there was, especially in the 1968 election, the supposition that there was a silent majority in America. It was Spiro Agnew, I think, who quoted that phrase in the 1968 campaign. He was Richard Nixon's vice presidential candidate. And he basically was reaching out to the older generation, the greatest generation, if you will follow Tom Brokaw's book title, the people who fought and won in World War II, fought and won, or at least got a draw out of Korea, and the people who believed in their government's righteousness. People who did not support the war tended to be much younger and were potentially much more endangered by the war. Nobody over 30 was being drafted and forced into a uniform, handed a gun, and sent to die. So it was very much an age gap, a generation gap was what we called it back then, that separated pro-war and anti-war. Well, nobody's really pro-war, but America, right and wrong, it doesn't matter, right? You know, love it or leave it was one of the phrases that was used back then by the supporters of government policy. If you don't love America, leave it. Well, I don't think standing up to the country doing something wrong is not loving your country. It's just disagreeing with the people who are making a bad decision.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that in the general public they had a different reaction to the draft than students did? Because I was actually reading this article, I think it was from PBS, where they were saying how, at least at the University of Wisconsin, like, the bottom, like, 30% of students would, you know, have their like, I forget what it was called, but their kind of, like, you know, pass, because they were a student, they would have that revoked. Do you think that students, like you were saying, because it's more based on age, do you think students had more of a reaction, and that's what we saw a lot of protests on campuses, as opposed to maybe less concentrated protests elsewhere?
I think at that point in time, students, encouraged by their faculty, suddenly realized that they were a demographic group that had voice, had agency. The fact that they were imperiled, I think, probably compelled some of them, at least, to protest. I know that I was active in protests in the very early 70s. Not so much because I was imperiled, but because I felt it was a wrong place to be. I think that the war was a major mistake. It had been going on, our involvement in Vietnam had been going on for well over a decade at that point. We got involved there in 1954. What a lot of people don't realize is there was a whole decade before Lyndon Johnson upped our troop presence in Vietnam. We had been sucked in 1954. So for me, it was more the wrongness of it as opposed to the personal peril. But for other people, I imagine it probably was, especially if later on when they changed the way they were selecting people for the draft. When you got a lottery number, you had no protection.
You were talking earlier about how you knew someone who was a veteran on your college campus, and that he had some pretty, you know, grisly stories. How do you think veterans were received coming back to the U.S. from Vietnam, and how is it different from veterans coming back from prior wars?
Whoa, it was completely different from the way veterans were welcomed back from World War II and Korea. In World War II, of course, we had an actual bone to pick, first with Japan, and then when Germany declared war on us too. And there was a sense of total national involvement during World War II. The people at home were rationing. You couldn't buy tires, you couldn't buy sugar, you couldn't buy coffee. American production was almost totally dedicated to producing war material, and the people at home had their lives changed. By the time we get to Vietnam, the vast majority of people in the United States didn't see anything about the war being affecting them. There were no shortages. There was no need to divert manufacturing capacity to supply the Army or the Marines or the Navy or the Air Force. it just wasn't necessary. We had already dedicated a vast amount of our national production into war materials anyway. So there was no hardship to any family that didn't have a child overseas in Vietnam. As far as welcoming the veterans home, welcoming back people who went and put their lives on the line for their country, I'm personally disgusted with the way that people back then welcomed our veterans home. Most of them didn't go to Vietnam by choice. They went because they had to. A disproportionate number of poor people, a disproportionate number of black people were rounded up, forced into service, and sent to go fight and die or be maimed. And they were then welcomed home by people spitting at them and calling them war criminals. And it was just awful, absolutely awful. So prior wars, everybody understood why we were in them. We supported them as a people. The Vietnam War was unpopular. It involved what was basically indentured servants fighting, and it was wrong. And unfortunately, the result was that veterans were not well received when they came home, and that is a national disgrace.
Do you think that the response and how different it was to veterans coming back from Vietnam spurred any kind of government policy, any kind of increased veteran aid, or did that come later on with later conflicts?
I don't think the government responded nearly enough with aid to veterans after Vietnam. They still pretty much ignored the results of combat trauma. So many of our veterans who came home from Vietnam were subject to depression and PTSD when we didn't know what PTSD was. There was a different name for it back then. I think the government response to that is woeful, and it's not getting much better.
You're listening to 91.7 WNEC-FM, New England College Radio, Henniker, New Hampshire. In what ways did the anti-war counterculture response extend into American culture, like through movies, literature, art, TV?
Well, the counterculture has certainly affected pretty much every aspect of American culture since the 60s. We see film, literature, plays that play up what the counterculture was and did. We see a lot of changes that the counterculture produced. Changes in our religion. Many churches, sects of Christianity, changed the way their worship services were held. They brought in folk music instead of the old, more classical music or gospel music. The Catholic Church brought in reforms like saying Mass in English instead of in Latin. They changed vestments, they changed decor, they made themselves far more open to people coming in. So there was a certain, I'm going to borrow a word and say, liberalization in our society. The counterculture liberated women, it liberated people of color, it liberated church-going people, and it liberated people who wanted to party, people who wanted to experiment with either illegal or very dangerous drugs. And then, as a result of that, we see the conservative backlash to the counterculture that kicks in the mid to late 70s and really propels itself forward then in the 80s under Reagan and Bush. And we see the results of that in our last election here.
Speaking of culture and, you know, movies, plays, and TV, How did the televised coverage of the war impact Americans' perception of armed conflict, global politics, and the news in general?
That's a really interesting question, because the Vietnam War was the first basically live televised war. You wouldn't know from what you watched on the 6:30 news every night that you were getting 24 hour later coverage. But it was. There was no way technologically to get footage all the way from Vietnam to Los Angeles or New York so that it go on the air at 6:30 at night on the same night that it happened. But you were getting 24 hours later the actual footage from what was going on in combat. And it was an eye-opener for a lot of people. There's no such thing of that kind of coverage happening before the Vietnam War. If you saw anything about what happened in World War II, you were either there or you were sitting in a darkened theater on the weekend watching a newsreel at the beginning of your movie of choice. There was no TV news coverage. There was a little bit of radio news coverage, but it wasn't combat. It was broadcast from London or from another major city. When you saw the icons put up with the American serviceman and the Vietnamese communist and the numbers next to them, those were something that you looked at every night. And of course, the person who was reading all the news to you was Walter Cronkite, who was, in his time, considered to be the most trustworthy man in all of America. Today, we look at our media differently. We have one side of our political spectrum that says that the media are the enemy of the people, and another side of the spectrum that says that without the media, we are no longer a people. So we need to parse our sources as viewers, as consumers of news, and we should never, ever, ever take anything at face value, no matter what the source is, because there are so many liars out there. There are so many countries that are trying to feed us disinformation to disrupt our society that we can't afford to. We can't afford to take anybody at their word.
Speaking of Walter Cronkite, when he had that very famous, you know, condemnation in a way on his broadcast of the Vietnam War, how do you think the reaction to that, you know, some of the backlash he got, how do you think that has extended into our current view of the news media?
I don't think that anybody who actually believed that Cronkite was telling the truth were negatively affected by that. CBS News in general has long been recognized as the voice of reality in news. Cronkite's immediate successor, Dan Rather, just published an article over the weekend about his dismay with CBS News settling a lawsuit with the Trump campaign. The Trump campaign contending that CBS slandered them and suing CBS for $10 billion.
Wow.
And CBS has, the parent company of CBS News, has decided to settle. And Dan Rather is lamenting the fact that CBS News is no longer the same organization that he worked for or that Walter Cronkite worked for. And it's not. Major media companies are just what I just said. They're companies. Their job is to fill their bottom line. And their job is no longer being permitted to be give us the best news coverage and truest news coverage that they can. So in some ways, I can agree with both sides of the media examination. You must question the major media, just as you would question some Yahoo on Facebook posting some crazy garbage. you just have to question everything and dig in and see. I don't personally see any recriminations on Walter Cronkite for criticizing the government. He had every reason to criticize what the government was doing, and the misinformation that they gave to the media was ridiculous.
Do you think that the media played any role in the concealment of, you know, the true numbers, the reality of the Vietnam War, or do you think that it was mostly government pressure that eventually just stopped being effective?
The news media did not suppress any of the numbers. They were fed numbers by the Pentagon. They were fed numbers by the high command in Vietnam. If you recall, William Westmoreland sued 60 Minutes and Mike Wallace as a result of their revelation of the way he had been lying to them. They called him a liar on TV, and he sued them for it, and he lost. The court found for CBS News they weren't telling lies. The government was. Well, when you say the government, that's nobody in particular. William Westmoreland, the commander of American troops in Vietnam, was lying. And it was his policy to inflate the numbers of enemies killed and suppress the numbers of Americans killed. End of discussion.
We are strong, we are resilient, and we will get through this together. But these are stressful times, and it's important to also practice good self-care. It's normal to feel overwhelmed, anxious, or afraid, but there is hope. Reach out to someone, connect with your friends, stay in touch with your community, and know that you are not alone. Learn more at wearebroadcasters.com/hope, furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station. Do you think that there is a similar distrust of the government, again, when it comes to certain war crimes that happen overseas? You know, we saw that with some things in Afghanistan that came out later on about things that went on that, you know, shouldn't have happened. And can you compare that to the reaction to the My Lai massacre and how that didn't come out immediately? It took, you know, a few years for that to kind of be revealed to the public.
Well, My Lai was a kick in the gut to the American people to think that sons of American citizens were able to go over there and do that sort of thing was sort of a real shock to the system back then. Remember that our history books said that America was the good guy. We were the white hats. We were the country that liberated everybody. We fought a war for democracy in the mid-40s. We fought a war for democracy in Korea. Everything we did was for the good of the country and the good of the world. At least that's what we thought. And then when we saw that Americans were capable of that kind of atrocity, it knocked everybody back on their heels, no matter where they were on the political spectrum. Modern war crimes are mostly hushed up just as much as anything that happens. We lay them off on aberrations. You know, something was wrong with that guy. He had mental problems before that. Or we pin them on civilian contractors, whatever it is. It's a human thing. We know that humans are capable of horrible atrocities. So when you throw enough people into a situation like that, you're bound to have things happen. They happened in Guantanamo. They happened on the streets of Tehran. They happened everywhere. They always will, unfortunately.
Do you think that the draft at the time and the reaction that the American people had has continued to leave a mark on, you know, young people today who have fears of the potential of us having another conflict that the government decides to enact another draft? Do you think that that's kind of translated over to, you know, contemporary young people, or do you think that it's not the same?
I think you're right. I've actually heard students express that concern. I, at this point, would sort of almost laugh it off if I hadn't seen the results of this past presidential election, and the results of only 2 weeks in the new administration. I think I'm seeing things happen in this country that 20 years ago I wouldn't have believed could happen. And so what I would normally have said in the 2000s and the 2010s, I can't say to a student today, oh, that's not going to happen. Congress would never pass another draft act. And at this point, I don't know that that's true. We had a law that was still in effect from World War II. So it wasn't, it didn't take a big, risky political decision to bring the draft into use for the Vietnam War. Today, it would require Congress to pass a law in the face of a lot of protest. I cannot imagine certain people in our Congress today having the nerve to do that. A lot of them wouldn't have the moral deficiency to do it, but I don't think a lot of them would have the guts to do it, unless, and I'll couch it in this term, unless we were blatantly attacked again by a national actor, a real governmental actor, not a terrorist attack, but if we were drawn into a war by another country, I could see the possibility of a draft being reinstated. But other than that, I don't see it happening.
Can you make any parallels between the culture surrounding the Vietnam War at the time and our current political climate and how polarizing it is?
Oh, wow. The conflict over Vietnam was polarizing, but not to the extent that anybody would condemn. A few people would condemn and criticize LBJ in popular culture, sure. People criticized Nixon in popular culture. Laugh-In, the famous sketch show. They were all over politicians back there. The birth of Saturday Night Live, in fact, happens before or right after the end of the Vietnam War. So, you know, that kind of counterculture entertainment made its impact on our culture fighting against the war. Today's culture, we don't have the same SharePoints that we had back then. You know, in the 60s and 70s, there were three networks. And if you were watching TV at home, you were watching one of those networks. You didn't have any other options. Today, if you're not reading a newspaper and you're not watching network news, which practically no one in your generation is doing it, where are you getting your news from? You're getting your news from social media. You're getting your news from websites. Maybe you're a subscriber to CNN online. Maybe you're a subscriber to a major newspaper online. Maybe all the news you get is what you hear in a classroom or over coffee at the cafe. But you're getting bombarded with information practically 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The internet is never silent. What you make of that information is what matters. I think that today's student generation, the normal student group between 18 and 24, are woefully underinformed in what's going on in the world. I think that my generation is even possibly even more woefully informed in what's going on in the world, because we're being fed a very carefully curated diet of nothing from the media. Maybe studying the internet is a better idea. I hope it will be in the long run. I hope that the democratization of information that happens because of the internet, as we see it evolving for the next 20 years, I hope we see that smoothing out into something that you find more and more truth on it than you do lies. I'm not somebody that's going to preach against social media or against the internet. I'm more of a futurist and utopian believer than that. I want to believe that this is a technology that is going to make utopia possible, not one that's going to make autocracy more possible.
And one last question, it's pretty loaded. Do you think the average American perception of the Vietnam War is full and accurate, and has it changed over time? And also, what about it, if anything, do you wish was talked about more?
I think the only thing important to talk about in the Vietnam War is the causes that got us there. Our foreign policy was structured around two central goals. One, stop the spread of communism around the world, and two, to make sure that any other enemy of our country would know that if they were to attack us, that they would be destroyed just as much as we would. The idea of mutually assured destruction. Well, now, 50, 60 years later, we're living in a situation where one missile launch could end up destroying the entire world. That's all it takes. One lousy missile coming out of North Korea or anywhere else in the world would bring about the destruction of the planet. We need to be aware of that. But more importantly, I think we need to be aware of what our government is trying to do. We need to have a focused foreign policy, a steady foreign policy, a focused domestic policy, and a steady domestic policy. The unfortunate, chaotic roller coaster ride of our politics nowadays is too much. The play and unplay of Democrat, Republican, liberal, conservative, all of that is the unevenness and the unfocusedness of it is too much for a country to stay on track. In a way, I sort of envy the Chinese, because their government, while it is a total autocracy, at least it's planning for the future. And when it plans for the future, the next guy doesn't come along and change everything. And we need to get back to where we were 20 years ago, when the difference between a Republican and a Democrat was whether or not to raise the allocation of funds to the military. Everybody was agreed that America came first, that we needed to make sure that our infrastructure was sound, that our people were protected, that our homeless had homes, that our hungry had food, and that we were safe in the world. And today we're playing games over things that are really at the heart of them so trivial that it boggles the mind. We need stability. We don't need to be told who to vote for. We don't need to be told what to do in the future. We don't need autocracy. We just need the extremes of our country to just shut up and go home and have the people who care about the American people governing us.
All right, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Well, you're very welcome. Have a great evening.
You as well.